Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour's worth of readings that cover news, history, opinions, and information about the African American community. Today I'll have readings from Literary Hub magazine and its lithub.com website, the New York Amsterdam News, the website cleveland.com, and I'm going to get started with some articles from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. The official theme for Black History Month in 2024 was African Americans in the Arts. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper had a series of stories based on that theme that were published during the month of February. This is one of them. The title of my next story is Chitlin' Circuit. It was Black Performers' Road to Fame. It was written by Fran Jeffries and published February 3, 2023 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The subtitle to the story is, Circuit Served as a Wide-Ranging Showcase During Segregation. For those who aren't from around here, chitlins are a soul food dish made from pig intestines. The dish dates to American slavery when the master ate high on the hog, keeping the ham and the bacon, while giving his slaves the less desirable parts, among them the chitterlings or chitlins. Much like the lowly chitlins that nurtured slaves, the chitlin circuit nurtured Black musicians, actors, and other entertainers during the era of racial segregation. The chitlin circuit grew out of a time when Blacks were not allowed to perform at white establishments. From the 1930s until the 1960s, the chitlin circuit was in its heyday. The network consisted of Black-owned nightclubs, dance halls, juke joints, and theaters in the South, on the East Coast, and parts of the Midwest. Black musicians and other performers flourished at these welcoming venues in the era of Jim Crow. Clubgoers could buy soul food at these venues, but the big payoff was seeing top-notch Black entertainers, blues, gospel, and R&B performers who got their start in the chitlin circuit. It was African Americans making something beautiful out of something ugly, said music historian Preston Lauterbach, author of the 2011 book, The Chitlin Circuit and the Road to Rock and Roll. It was one of the few places that Black culture could be celebrated during Jim Crow, he said. Many renowned Black performers owe their start to the Chitlin Circuit. On the circuit, artists such as B.B. King, Bobby Blue Bland, Sam Cooke, Ike and Tina Turner and Otis Redding helped give birth to modern-day Black music. In addition, some of Georgia's greatest musicians cut their teeth on the circuit, including Ray Charles, James Brown, Gladys Knight and the Pips, and Little Richard. Lauterbach highlighted Little Richard as a prime example of a consummate chitlin circuit entertainer. Early in his career, Little Richard performed in the circuit clubs in Georgia and other states as a female impersonator, as part of a rambunctious group called the Temple Toppers, and as a solo performer. All this was acceptable, even expected of performers on the circuit, Lauterbach said. Georgia had its share of venues on the circuit. One of the best known was the Royal Peacock in Atlanta, which still is operating. Other Georgia venues include the Douglas Theater in Macon, the Morton Theater in Athens, and the Liberty Theater in Columbus. By the 1970s, these venues had fallen on hard times, but thanks to grassroots efforts, they were renovated. Lauterbach's book explores the connection between the chitlin circuit and rock and roll music. Most performers in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame had some connection to the chitlin circuit. Even the Jackson 5 got their start on the circuit, he said. Not everyone liked referring to the circuit by the name of lowly pig entrails, said Lauterbach. There were people who embraced that name and others who found it to be second class. Blues great Bobby Rush embraced the heck out of it, Lauterbach noted. Rush called himself the king of the chitlin circuit. The mainstream success of artists such as Little Richard coupled with integration led to the downturn of the chitlin circuit. It still survives, though nothing like in its heyday. That was the article, Chitlin Circuit. It was Black Performers' Road to Fame. It was written by Fran Jeffries and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on February 3rd, 2024. Next, I have an opinion piece about Black History Month. It's from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper and was published February 12, 2024. It was written by Bill Nygood, and the title is Days to Honor Rue During Black History Month. Last week, as I was scrolling through dates on the Georgia Historical Society's terrific website, Today in Georgia History, I noticed there are many events that took place in February, Black History Month, that inform us about the arc of history of African Americans in Georgia. Some of the February dates allow us to reflect on the extraordinary accomplishments of Black Georgians. Others remind us of the fraught history of the Black experience in our state, the advances as well as the cruel setbacks for Georgia's African Americans. I was alternately moved, dismayed, and proud of living here as I marched through the state calendar of February events and anniversaries. On February 12, 1733, that Georgia was founded as an abolitionist colony by the British social reformer and military leader James Oglethorpe. Oglethorpe's charter prohibited slavery, the only one of the 13 colonies to do so. But it wouldn't last long. In 1751, with Oglethorpe back in England and disengaged from the affairs of Georgia, the trustees of the colony bowed to pressure from owners of rice plantations and reversed the ban on chattel slavery, which lasted for more than 100 years until the Civil War finally brought it to an end. On February 5, 1945, Governor Ellis Arnold abolished a Jim Crow law that established a poll tax designed to block Black Georgians from voting. The tax had been in place for more than 60 years, having been written into the state constitution of 1877 to counter the adoption of the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which gave former slaves the right to vote. But in the years that followed Ellis's order, we know that other barriers preventing Georgia Black citizens from voting continued in force. Other February dates remind us of the continuing efforts of white Georgia leaders to keep segregation alive. On February 6, 1956, Governor Marvin Griffin spoke before a joint session of the state legislature. He urged lawmakers to take action to nullify the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision. The legislature took up the charge and passed a measure declaring the state had the sovereign right to maintain segregated schools, despite the Supreme Court's landmark ruling ordering U.S. schools to integrate. School desegregation didn't begin in the state until 1961, and many Georgia schools remained segregated until the 1970s. On February 13, 1956, the legislature underscored its defiance of the Supreme Court school desegregation order by voting to change the Georgia flag, adopting a design that featured the Confederate battle emblem as the most prominent element of the new flag. It wasn't until 2001 that Governor Roy Barnes muscled through the legislature a new flag that minimized the rebel emblem. That controversial accomplishment was a major factor in Barnes's loss in his re-election bid. On February 29, 1940 in Los Angeles, Gone with the Wind, which depicted a Georgia fighting gallantly to preserve his Southern heritage, was awarded 8 Oscars, including for Best Picture. The movie was beloved by a wide range of audiences, but it also became a clarion call to those Southerners who embraced the false revisionist history of the Lost Cause. Gone with the Wind remains one of the most popular films ever made and continues to be shown frequently on television, even as communities across Georgia have removed monuments and other tributes to the Lost Cause from public spaces. And then there are the February dates that allow us to celebrate the individual achievements of Black Georgians. On February 4th, we honor the memory of Clinch County's Ossie Davis, who had a celebrated career as an actor, playwright, and civil rights leader. Davis was a master of ceremonies at the March on Washington and was there to hear the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. proclaim, "I have a dream." Davis and his wife, the equally acclaimed actor Ruby Dee, formed a 50-year creative partnership that endures as one of the great love stories of American theater and film. February 9th is the birthday of celebrated author Alice Walker, who is best known for her novel, The Color Purple. In 1982, Walker became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize in fiction for her harrowing portrayal of 4 decades in the life of Sally, who faced bigotry and abuse in rural Georgia in the early 1900s. Jim Brown, who was born on St. Simon's Island on February 17, 1936, went on to become one of the greatest football players of all time. Another Georgia athlete, Tiger Flowers of Camilla, on February 26, 1936, became the first black boxer to win the middleweight championship of the world. And then there are the birthdays of two towering figures of civil rights. W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the most influential black intellectuals of the 20th century, was born on February 23, 1868. He came to Atlanta to teach at Atlanta University in 1897 and was a powerful voice for giving African Americans equal rights and a bigger voice in political affairs. Appalled by the Atlanta race riots of 1906, Du Bois became one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People 3 years later. Finally, we come to one of the great heroes of contemporary Georgia and American history. John Lewis was born on February 24, 1940. His story is well known, and given his accomplishments in fighting for civil rights and equal justice for all, an entire month could be dedicated simply to his life and work. But I'll gladly remember John Lewis's birthday as part of the journey of African Americans in Georgia, which we see revealed in events and occasions that, by sheer coincidence, took place in February, the month we honor Black history. That was an opinion piece titled, Days to Honor Rue During Black History Month. It appeared in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 12, 2024, and was written by Bill Nygut. My next story is titled, Cleveland, Next City Chosen to Preserve African American History Through Digitization Curation Program. It was published January 28, 2024, at the cleveland.com website, and was written by Kaylee Remington. East Mount Zion Baptist Church curated the stories of African Americans who traveled to the Cleveland area during the Great Migration in its own museum to make sure they wouldn't be lost to time. Now, Cleveland is taking another step in preserving African American history. Cleveland is the next stop in a key initiative that digitizes and curates African American history. A national program backed by the Smithsonian Institute and several other groups that want to close the generational digital gap in cities across the country. The start of the journey began Saturday, January 27th, at East Mount Zion Baptist Church, where hundreds attended the Community Curation Summit. Community members and leaders attended the summit to collaborate on preserving their stories and to learn more about keeping their memories and family heirlooms alive. The summit was hosted by the church with support from the Western Reserve Historical Society, the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, the Smithsonian Institute, the Robert F. Smith Center for the Digitization and Curation of African American History, the Rashad Center Incorporated, and more. Panelists at the event focused on the goal of digitization and curation of African American history. The Smithsonian Institute has already visited other diverse communities, including Chicago and Nashville, to help them digitize, save, and preserve family heirlooms and history. Tracy Jackson, a spokeswoman for the church, said before the summit, four representatives of the Smithsonian have been in Cleveland since early this week, visiting various institutions like the Cleveland Museum of Art, Severance Hall, Cleveland State University, and Oberlin College, places that have archives, historical data, and places that are in the process of digitizing history. Cleveland has been tapped as being the next city that they would do this process in, Jackson said. Cleveland is blessed to be considered for this. Saturday's event also included performances, various panel speakers, and breakout sessions to encourage collaboration among attendees. Jackson said Saturday's event was the project's inception. Cleveland residents are starting to figure out how they can preserve their memories and how the communities in Cleveland can collaborate with one another and the Smithsonian Institute. Now that we have the resources and the Smithsonian backing us, how are we going to empower one another, commit to this project, and work together to bring it to pass and take these next 5 months to get boots on the ground and let our communities know what's going on, Jackson said. So much of African American history is untold, said the Reverend Brian Cash of East Mount Zion Baptist Church in an interview before the summit with Cleveland.com and The Plain Dealer. This initiative will allow the history and culture to be available for generations to come through the digitization and curation process the Smithsonian is offering cities across the country. African American families have contributed to America in so many different ways, but because they don't know how to tell their own story, these stories never get told, he said. So what the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. said is, hey, we have this huge museum in D.C. that talks about the broader scope of African American history, but there's so much more history that's still left untold. Because of this void in the history, Robert Smith of the Robert F. Smith Center for the Digitization and Curation of African American History gave money to the Smithsonian for curators to travel across the country to go into these areas where you have very different people trying to bring history together or cultivate history or do storytelling, but don't have the funds or the skills to be able to bring a story alive and tell it in a strategic way to tell that story, Cash said. Cleveland is one of those cities, he said. In Cleveland, we hear a lot about Martin King, Carl Stokes and Lewis Stokes, Fannie Lewis and Stephanie Tubbs Jones. These are people whose stories aren't really known, he said. And these families of generations have these stories, but they weren't curated in the right way, Cash said. It's especially special that the summit took place at East Mount Zion Baptist Church because the Greenstone Project sparked the first conversation of African American history to be digitized, curated, and brought back to the forefront. The Greenstone Project, or Greenstone Church, comes from the color of the exterior facade of the East Mount Zion Baptist Church. It is one of Ohio's only serpentine stone buildings. The church's own museum explores African Americans who traveled to the Cleveland area during the Great Migration, Cash said, during a live stream of the summit event Saturday. Our museum highlights those stories because so many of African Americans' stories were dying and their stories were going to the grave, he said. We said we wanted to curate those stories, and we're so thankful to be able to have a museum that highlights those stories. That was the article, Cleveland, Next City to Preserve African American History Through Digitization Curation Program. It was written by Kaylee Remington, published January 28, 2024, and it appeared at the cleveland.com website. My next reading is from the black newspaper out of New York City, the New York Amsterdam News, and its amsterdamnews.com website. The title of this op-ed is From Video Game Consumers to Video Game Producers. It was written by David Jones and published January 4, 2024. We all know that video games play an important role in the lives of young people, particularly young people of color. But what if we could harness that interest in game playing to develop personal and professional skills such as critical thinking, communication, complex problem solving, and teamwork skills? To take it one step further, what if we could leverage the popularity of video game playing to inform more students of color about the growing educational and career opportunities in the digital games industry? And in doing so, put more of them on a pathway to the lucrative and diversifying high-tech workplace. For those of us who are not video game enthusiasts, count me among them, the video game industry is big business. In 2023, the worldwide video games market is projected to reach a revenue of $249.6 billion and grow to $389 billion by 2028. The United States video games market is projected to reach a revenue of $68.2 billion by 2023 and grow to $111 billion by 2028. In 2023, it is estimated that 268,698 people were employed in the U.S. video games market. Not surprisingly, the overwhelming majority of these jobs, which pay very well, are dominated by white males. This despite research indicating that blacks and Latinos are the industry's most enthusiastic consumers. Indeed, a 2015 study by the Pew Research Center showed that 83% of non-Hispanic black teenagers play video games, compared to 71% of white teenagers, with 69% of Latino teens not too far behind. In 2023, the numbers had shifted. Bloomberg News reported in July 2023 that Latino, 79%, and black Americans, 77%, followed by Asian/Pacific Islanders, 67%, play video games more than white Americans, 62%, according to an annual industry report. With the continued growth of the global video gaming industry and the major role people of color play as consumers, one might expect more characters and storylines reflecting the diverse cultures of people of color would be more prevalent. However, that has not been the case. Instead, the prevailing narratives found in video games by and large reflect the experiences and sensibilities of the sector's white male leadership. As such, people of color have been portrayed in negative stereotypical roles. Only recently have some of the major video game companies begun portraying people of color characters and their stories more accurately. This trend has created a growing interest on the part of industry leaders to hire people of color and thereby capitalize on a lost business opportunity to expand their consumer base. To find that pipeline of talent and diversify the industry, New York City-based video game companies should look at the youth in New York City. In 2021, the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment, MOME, released a report calling on the city to diversify and grow the size of the digital gaming industry, which in 2020 supported 7,600 jobs, $762 million in wages, and $2 billion in economic output. Mayor Adams has repeatedly stated he wants to see more students of color becoming producers of digital games and not simply consumers. To that end, he launched the Gaming Pathways programs in 2022 with an investment of $2 million to create a pathway from high school to the City College of New York and then into careers in the digital gaming industry. Gaming Pathways is a partnership involving CCNY, which is creating a new bachelor's degree program in digital game development. Urban Arts, a nonprofit that has been operating programs in the Title I high schools that use game design to promote STEAM, Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Mathematics, and the Harlem Gallery of Science, whose initial study played an important role in creating the Gaming Pathways program. The Harlem Gallery of Science, HGS, uses culturally sensitive experiential learning programs, team-building exercises, and interactive exhibitions to attract and prepare its target group, underrepresented youth, ages 11 through 24, for undergraduate education and careers in STEAM fields. HGS's latest exhibition is called Video Games, The Great Connector, and opens on February 3, 2024 at the Harlem School of Arts. The exhibition, which is geared to middle and high school students, may be a real revelation for caregivers and parents who often think of video games as a waste of time. They will discover that playing video games can lead to high-paying jobs in the digital games industry and related creative fields. Visitors to the exhibit will have an opportunity to play games and uncover the invisible design influencing their game experience. Most importantly, students will have an opportunity to explore educational and career pathways that match their interests and skills. On a final note, more of the city's tech companies should be participating in the city's Summer Youth Employment Program. If we're serious about building a more inclusive local economy and getting employers to develop talent pipelines from underrepresented communities, that seems like a good place to start. That was the op-ed titled, From Video Game Consumers to Video Game Producers. It was written by David R. Jones and appeared in the New York Amsterdam News on January 4, 2024. If you've just joined us, you're listening to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner. Next on today's African American Hour is an op-ed from the New York Amsterdam News newspaper. The title is, We Must Work Together to Support HBCU Sustainability in America. It was written by Ben Chavis and published January 11, 2024. Earlier this year, the U.S. Department of Education sent all colleges and universities across the nation a notice, reminding them that they have to comply with the newly updated cybersecurity regulations published by the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC. The regulations, which include specifications such as implementing critical controls for information security programs, maintaining oversight of service providers, and designating an individual to oversee a school's cybersecurity infrastructure, came in response to an uptick in ransomware attacks on schools around the United States. While these regulations are certainly warranted in an age when personal data is becoming increasingly vulnerable to cyber criminals, the penalties for failing to comply with the regulations, especially the withholding of federal needs-based funding under Title IV, pose an existential threat to schools operating under tight budgets. Take historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, which have throughout their existence struggled to find the substantial funding that many state and private predominantly white institutions, PWIs, of higher education enjoy, and are already steeling themselves to deal with an expected surge of applicants in the wake of the Supreme Court's regressive decision to effectively end affirmative action admissions programs. The loss of Title IV funding would drastically affect about 80% of the student bodies at HBCUs and have a consequential negative impact on the future of these vital institutions of higher education. Endowments at HBCUs pale in comparison with those at the U.S.'s top-ranked colleges and universities, with the overall endowments at all the country's HBCUs accounting for less than a tenth of Harvard's alone. The gap in funding between PWIs and HBCUs isn't just because of smaller endowments. It's also because state lawmakers keep funds off HBCU campuses. In North Carolina, for example, legislators awarded North Carolina State an extra $79 million for research, while North Carolina A&T, the nation's largest HBCU, only received $9.5 million. When it comes to access to technology, HBCUs also face an uphill battle, with 82% of HBCUs being located in so-called broadband deserts. Despite the struggles with funding and the fact that these schools constitute only 3% of four-year colleges in the country, HBCU graduates account for 80% of all black judges, 50% of black lawyers, 50% of black doctors, 40% of black members of Congress, and our country's current vice president. HBCUs truly know how to do more with less, but they cannot be saddled with costly regulations that pose an existential crisis to their ability to operate and be given no help to deflect some of the costs. Fortunately, however, there are businesses and individuals who see the importance of HBCUs to the black community and are willing to lend their hands and their dollars to support them. The Student Freedom Initiative, SFI, a nonprofit chaired by philanthropist and entrepreneur Robert F. Smith and funded by major tech companies like Cisco, has raised millions of dollars to help HBCUs comply with the Education Department's mandates. Cisco alone donated $150 million to the SFI, with $100 million allocated to bringing HBCU cybersecurity system upgrades into compliance, and $50 million going to establishing an endowment to offer alternative student loans. With $89 million already distributed to 42 HBCUs across the nation, the initiative has saved about $1.5 billion in needs-based funding to these colleges and universities, and is making strong inroads in helping these institutions meet the new cybersecurity regulations. But more is required if all HBCUs are to be saved. Given the empowering impact HBCUs have on the nation's black community and the future promise of a more inclusive America, it is imperative that more companies support the work the Student Freedom Initiative is doing to ensure these vital higher education schools can continue to educate and inspire future generations. As Vice President Kamala Harris said, "What you learn at an HBCU is you do not have to fit into somebody's limited perspective on what it means to be young, gifted, and black." We in the National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education stand in strong support of the Student Freedom Initiative. We all should work together to ensure the sustainability of HBCUs in America. That was an op-ed out of the New York Amsterdam News newspaper titled, "We Must Work Together to Support HBCU Sustainability in America." It was published January 11, 2024. The op-ed piece was written by Dr. Benjamin F. Chavis, Jr., who is chair of the National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education and president and CEO of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. I'm going to wrap up today's program with the book excerpt. My next reading is about some of the people that were brought to Mobile, Alabama, on the last known slave ship to the United States in 1860. The name of the ship was the Clotilda, and it brought 110 Africans to the United States. This book excerpt is from the book The Survivors of the Clotilda, The Lost Stories of the Last Captives of the American Slave Trade by Hannah Durkin. I found this at the website lithub.com, and the name of the story at the website is Paradise Lost, How the Transatlantic Slave Trade Helped Fuel Violent Conflict in West Africa. Subtitled, Hannah Durkin on the Memories of the Survivors of the Slave Ship Clotilda. It was published January 31, 2024, and was written by Hannah Durkin. The male and female warriors who stole the liberty and destroyed the town of those trafficked to the United States of the slave ship Clotilda launched their assault before dawn. The townsfolk were taken by surprise and had no time to defend themselves against the Fon warriors of the Kingdom of Dahomey, a regional power located in present-day Benin. Some of the town's farmers, keen to complete their labors before they grew hot that day in mid-April 1860, had already left its parameters to plant their corn, groundnut, and melon crops when the army struck. The warriors killed them all to ensure no one could warn their neighbors of an impending attack. Even at the end of his life, a medium-sized, balding man with a small goatee beard and a missing fingertip named Consula, capital K-O-S-S-U-L-A, who became known in the United States as Cudjo Lewis, hugged his body in a self-protective gesture and rocked from side to side when recollecting the horrors of his kidnap. Warriors armed with machetes, axes, clubs, and flintlock muskets smashed the gates. Shaven-headed women in brown-belted cotton tunics, knee-length shorts, and white cotton skull caps attacked the town first. Male soldiers formed a second line of attack that caught those who sought to flee. Tall, round-faced Abache, capital A-B-A-C-H-E, was woken by the sound of shouts and gunfire. The 15-year-old girl jumped out of bed and tried to run away but was quickly captured. "When we all asleep, they come and take us," a small, slender-framed 12-year-old named Redoshi recalled at the end of her life. "I ran, but they caught me. I fought, but they beat me. I didn't know what they were saying, but it wasn't good." Alerted to the sounds of gunfire and screams, Kasula tried to flee into the woods, but there was no escape. The enemy had surrounded the town. After trying to bolt through his gates, Kasula slipped quietly into a neighbor's house and buried himself beneath a pile of rags. But women warriors soon wrenched him from his hiding place and took him hostage. Kasula wept at the memory. "Oh, oh, I ran this way to that gate, but they there. I ran to another one, but they there too. All eight gates. They there. Them women, they very strong. I 19 years old, but they too strong for me. They take me and tie me. I don't know where my people at. I never see them no more." Those who were not captured were cut down by giant blades and shot with guns and then decapitated. Kasula was forced to watch the brutal slaughter of his townsfolk. "I see the people get it killed so fast. The old ones, they try run away from the house, but they dead by the door, and the women soldiers got their head. Oh, Lord," he recalled, weeping and hugging his arms to his chest at the memory. Kasula begged in vain to be released to his mother and to be allowed to search for his family. "I begged him, please let me go back to my mama, but they don't pay what I say no attention." Many men and women died, and everyone else was taken prisoner. 2-year-old Matilda was kidnapped with her mother, Gracie, and 4-year-old siblings, but her father, Ossie, and Kasula's parents, Oluwale and Nufanlulu, were almost certainly among the dead. The town's ruler was brought before the king of Dahomey and beheaded with a giant black-handled razor when he refused to leave the land of his ancestors as a prisoner. The ruler chose immediate death over enslavement. The Clotilda captive's hometown, Takar, was wiped off the face of the earth by Fon warriors that mid-April morning. It does not appear on any map, but Kasula placed it at the heart of Yoruba land, the cultural home of the Yoruba people that comprises present-day southwest Nigeria and extends into Benin and Togo. 2 years before his death in 1935, Kasula told a Yoruba-speaking missionary that his home was about 75 miles from Abeokuta, the capital of Ogun State in southwest Nigeria, and a metropolis whose population of 110,000 rivaled that of Chicago then the United States' ninth biggest city. He also said that he traveled many times to Ogbomosho, a city of 70,000 people in neighboring Oyo State, and told Harper's Monthly magazine that he and his wife Abile were from Winnie. Historian Natalie S. Robertson has identified Winnie as Owini, Owini Hill, an elevation 3 miles northeast of the city of Oyo, on the Oyo-Ogbomosho Road, a major trade route east of the Ogun River linking Oyo with Ogbomosho. Owini Hill is about 65 miles in a straight line from Abeokuta. The survivors of the Clotilda would always remember their lost homeland as a paradise. Bananas introduced long ago by eastern traders, pineapples recently imported from the west, and enormous melons were so abundant in the forest around their town that the air was thick with the aroma. Know how we find them fruits? By the smell, Kosula explained of the fruit hunting game he played as a child. Polly Allen, a man whose round face was punctuated by deep-set expressive eyes and whose hair and goatee beard stayed dark even into old age, told the same story of material abundance to his children. He would always tell us how the climate was so much warmer in Africa and the soil was so much better. He always said he wanted to go back so bad. Polly's daughter, Clara Ava Bell Allen Jones, recalled, "You know, I never see my daddy ever eat a banana or an orange. I think maybe it made him homesick." Kosula and Poli emphasized the superior quality of their homes. The residents of Tarkar lived in 8-foot-tall round houses made from clay bricks 18 inches thick, with waterproof roofs constructed from palm poles bound together with cord and overlaid with earth and multiple layers of grass. Palm oil-fueled iron and earthenware lamps gave light to the windowless dwellings, whose walls were typically painted black or red. The bricks were impervious to fire, and a burnt-up roof could easily be rebuilt. The houses were built in circular formations so their inhabitants could more easily defend them against attack, a practice known as Akbo'ile, flock of houses, although the town's chief source of protection was its 8-man gates. Abache, who was kidnapped alongside her sister Yoruba, described in a soft, slow voice and expressive physical gestures the peaceful home life she enjoyed as a child. Her townsfolk were highly successful farmers whose labors were aided by an incredibly fertile landscape. Abache described how the men tilled the ground to plant yams and rice, and how the women traded harmoniously with other ethnic groups. "I live in Clean Village. I was much happy. My people weave cloth from grass, bathe in sunshine and river. No fights, no beatings, no killings. We live together like one family," Radoshi stressed of the childhood that brutally ended when she was 12 years old. As fellow child captive Kanko, a small light-skinned woman with a facial mark on her right cheek, explained to her children and grandchildren, the standard of living was high in her hometown. Like other African societies, Tarkar was not beholden to capitalistic notions of land ownership that regarded land as a commodity. Her town's ruler, whose name was recorded variously as Atbaku, Ibaku, and Akbana, and who Radoshi remembered as a good man, was the custodian of the land in his territory, which was communally owned and split between kinship groups and handed down the generations. Each family had access to its own portion of land, which could not be sold. The planting season began in February. The town's menfolk cleared weeds from the rust-colored earth with cutlasses, knives, and axes. They used short-handled hoes and bill hooks to prepare the ground for sowing. The earth was bountiful and there was no need for fertilizer or plows. They planted yams in February, then corn, groundnuts, and melons in April and May. After the August harvest, they planted a new crop of corn, beans, and groundnuts in September. Yams were a major crop in Oyo State, and Tarkar's yams grew so big, 2 feet long and 6 inches wide according to one regional eyewitness account, that no one could eat a single yam in one sitting. "We go away, we come back. Push, dig the dirt. Great big yam like keg, nail keg. We cut off vine with little piece of yam and cover it up again. Another big yam. Whole family couldn't eat at one time. For 7 years, we don't need no new seed. It keep making yams," Kosula explained. Yams were eaten in manifold ways. Their starchy white flesh could be turned into elubu, yam flour, added to stews, roasted, or boiled and crushed with a pestle and mortar to make iyan, pounded yam. The townsfolk extracted palm oil and beer from the fruit of palm trees and wove cloth from its leaves. The women owned and raised cows, pigs, chickens, goats, and sheep for a profit, which they kept in the inner court of their households to protect from predators. "Nobody ever go hungry. Nobody ever go cold," Kusula declared of his homeland at the end of his life. Children like Poli learned a craft from their parents and became proficient at that skill by the age of 16. He and other male Clotilda survivors, exiled to Mobile, were so good at woodwork that they handmade toys for their children and built and sold their own furniture. Many women, such as the young energetic Bougier, managed motherhood with trading responsibilities. The small, round-faced, dark-skinned woman had just become a mother for the third time in the spring of 1860, and she bound her baby in a sling on her back and balanced her wares on her head when heading to and from the vast market in Okbomosho. As one 19th century observer noted, selling crops at market was the peculiar privilege of Yoruba-speaking women, whose trading activities meant they had independent incomes. Palm oil was their dominant item of trade. Market trading was so important to Bougier's sense of self that she determinedly carried on the practice after her liberation from slavery. The long-lived woman traded twice a week at the heart of Alabama until she was physically unable to do so. The items Bougier encountered for sale at Okbomosho were far more luxurious than the foraged berries, plums, and medicinal plants that were her only available wares in exile, however. A U.S. missionary who went to Okbomosho in the late 1850s likened the experience to visiting any Anglo-Saxon city. Products from around the world could be sourced at the marketplace, which was neatly divided into relevant sections according to the produce and merchandise for sale, and which attracted thousands of people at a time. According to Kanko, the small, light-skinned girl with a facial mark on her right cheek, business was conducted with shillings, a silver coin linked to the British Empire that was used throughout present-day Nigeria. Cowries, porcelain-like seashells that served as religious objects among the Yoruba, were also exchanged as currency, and traders could be trusted to shop unsupervised and leave money for an item at the place of purchase for the seller to collect later. Stealing was so rare that possessions could be safely left in the open air. "Suppose I had left my purse in town in the public square," Kusula told an interviewer in the early 20th century. "Today I have not the time to go for it, nor tomorrow. Am I worried? No, for I know when I go I will find it where I left it." Could you do that in America? Crimes were tried in open court, and the punishment for murder was execution by sword, regardless of the criminal's wealth and social status. As Poli explained of an offender's powerlessness to buy their way out of punishment, "Money don't plea you there." There were enslaved peoples in Tarkar, including criminals, people forced temporarily into bondage to pay off debts, and people seized in warfare with other ethnic groups. Many were of northern, particularly Hausa origin, but their experiences of bondage were vastly different from the chattel slavery practiced in the Americas, which was centered on intense labor, reduced people to commodities that could be shipped around the world, and defined people in racialized terms so their enslaved status could be passed on to their children. Enslaved people in West Africa included soldiers and administrators, and social mobility was possible. Kasulo's grandfather was an officer of and regular companion to his town's king, who owned a large compound managed by several wives and enslaved laborers. Yet, his idle threat to sell the son of a captive laborer to a Portuguese slave trader for tobacco, when he disturbed him while sleeping, highlights how much more gratefully feared was sale overseas than enslavement at home. When Kasulo was nearly 15, he was thrilled to receive military training like his older brothers. The teenager spent whole nights in the woods being taught how to track and hunt deer, buffalo, elephants, lions, and leopards, how to stalk silently through the forest and conceal himself, how to leave a trail for others to follow, and how to make camp. Kasula learned how to shoot arrows and throw spears, and how to beat the drum that accompanied the town's war song. Kasula spent 5 years learning military skills that he understood were solely for defensive purposes. The community's economy was centered around agriculture, and the king had no plans to make war, but his people needed to be ready to defend their town against attack. While the boys learned how to hunt and fight, little Konko was taken to her mother, Konko, to gather medicinal plants and to learn the curative properties of the world around her. Although there were professional medical practitioners known as onisigun in Yoruba-speaking societies, herbal knowledge was a collective enterprise. After a day spent gathering curative herbs, Konko resisted her mother's call to go home and hid behind what she thought were beautiful large leaves for treating headaches. When she fetched Konko to point them out, the leaves came alive. The pair were face to face with the giant snake. Konko's horrified mother grabbed her child sharply by the hand when she saw the danger. Konko felt her feet leave the earth as Konko pulled her to safety. Hunters sought out the snake, but it had disappeared. Konko could not protect her daughter from all the dangers of her environment, however. Nearly 70 years after Konko's death, her granddaughter, Mabel Dennison, attempted to document the circumstances of her kidnap. Even though Konko was ripped from her homeland while still a child, she understood that slave traffickers deliberately stoked inter- and intra-ethnic divisions to create prisoners of war who could be shipped and sold overseas. As Mabel explained, she had learned that once these slave ships arrived on the African coast, there was little trouble in procuring a cargo of slaves, for it had long been a part of the trader's policy to instigate tribes against each other and, in this matter, keep the market stocked. There had been numerous wars with foreign countries as well as the surrounding nations, and also between tribes within her country. It seemed as though some kind of war would go on for years. Mabel suggested that Konko was from the town of Dahomey, and that she was kidnapped by slave traders while performing an errand for her mother at a local store. It's likely that Konko was from the same Yoruba-speaking town as Kosula. Like Poli, who never discussed the circumstances of his capture, Konko promptly concocted a tale of isolated kidnap because the destruction of her hometown and murder of her family was too harrowing to recall. Konko also told her descendants that she and Kosula were cousins, indicating that they grew up together in Tarkar, and as Mabel remembered, there was a close relationship in their ways and customs. The mid-19th century was a particularly dangerous time for Yoruba speakers such as Konko and Kosula. Yoruba was historically an umbrella term applied by missionaries who began arriving in the region after 1840 to different ethnic groups that shared the language and culture of the Oyo Empire of present-day western Nigeria and eastern Benin. The empire's origins stretched back to the 12th century and centered on the city-state of Oyo, Old Oyo, which was about 100 miles north of New Oyo and Tarkar. Its highly organized and commanding cavalry enabled it to capture surrounding territories and expand from a minor state to the most powerful empire in present-day southwest Nigeria by the end of the 16th century. While they were connected by common myths of origin and even shared a spiritual capital in the ancient city of Ile Ife, 50 miles southeast of Old Oyo in neighboring Osun State, each Yoruba group represented a largely autonomous city-state with its own industries and trade networks and its own Oba, or king, who ruled a capital town and its surrounding territories. For hundreds of years, the communities lived in relative peace with each other until invasions from Oyo's Muslim Fulani neighbors to the north, the rise of Dahomey and conflicts between the empire's Alafin, or emperor, and his advisors combined with popular resistance to an increasingly authoritarian aristocracy undermined the stability from the 1780s onwards. Yoruba-speaking territories lost vital trade routes and were plunged into competition and civil warfare for the next 8 decades, and Yoruba-speaking captives became victims of the transatlantic slave trade. The gradual disintegration of the Oyo Empire, followed by its total collapse in the 1830s, changed the balance of power in the region. Dahomey's capital, Abomey, was no longer vulnerable to assault by Oyo, and Yoruba-speaking communities east, northeast, and southeast of Abomey that previously were shielded by their association with Oyo were now open to attack by newly empowered Dahomey. Dahomey's king Gezo recognized the southeastern region around Abeokuta, a city recently founded by the Egba people. Yoruba-speaking refugees fleeing the collapse of Oyo would be easiest to attack. Annual battles between Dahomey and the Egba soon turned into a major ongoing conflict. The transatlantic slave trade fanned the flames of war. European hunger for African labor between the 16th and 19th centuries to power its newly established economies in the American hemisphere created a tragically self-perpetuating cycle of self-destruction on the African continent. This trade in human life fueled demographic breakdown and social instability, which in turn created military states compelled to engage in warfare instead of agriculture and trade prisoners for weapons to protect against their own people's transatlantic enslavement by foreigners. An estimated 10.7 million Africans were displaced to the Americas between the turn of the 17th and the late 19th centuries. An additional 15%, about 1.8 million people, died on the Atlantic voyage, and perhaps as many as 6 million more people died in slave raids on the journey to the West African coast and in the barracoons, or slave pens, that held them prisoner before they could be shipped across the ocean. An African person enslaved in the Americas had a life expectancy of around 7 years. In 1803, Denmark became the first nation to end its slave trade. The British Empire abolished the practice in its territories 4 years later, and the United States banned its trade on January 1, 1808, and declared it piracy in 1820. But illegal trade continued over the following decades. After being compelled to abolish its trade in 1814 by Britain, which had dominated the trade in the decades before 1807, but now led the campaign to end it, the Netherlands signed a treaty to comprehensively outlaw the practice in 1818. France, which had outlawed slavery altogether in 1794, before reinstating it under Napoleon Bonaparte in 1802, reimposed a trading ban the same year as the Netherlands. Spain promised to end its trade in 1820. Newly independent Brazil finally legislated against the traffic in 1831, and Portugal finally abolished the slave trade 5 years later. However, the bans were poorly enforced and even ignored, and more than 1 million people continued to be trafficked to Brazil and the Spanish island of Cuba even after 1836. More than 25% of all the transatlantic slave trade's victims, around 3.2 million people, were forced onto slave ships after the 1808 ban. Nearly 38%, 1.8 million of all Africans displaced to Brazil arrived after that time, and almost 71%, 552,000, of all Africans displaced to Cuba arrived after 1820. Dahomey's imperial growth and engagement in this trade was probably precipitated by a desire to protect his own citizens against the threat of transatlantic enslavement. As King Geisel's grandfather, King Kapengla, reportedly told a Yorkshire-born enslaver and slave trader in the 1780s, "You Englishmen are surrounded by the ocean, whilst we Dahomeans, being placed on a large continent and hemmed in amidst a variety of other people, are obliged by the sharpness of our swords to defend ourselves from their incursions and punish the depredations they make on us. Your countrymen, therefore, who allege that we go to war for the purpose of supplying your ships with slaves, are grossly mistaken." Nor was the Dahomey Empire the only military threat to the children and young people that ended up on the Clotilda. Although the Africans repeatedly referred to their captors as Dahomey warriors, so intense was the warfare between former members of the Oyo Empire, whose own growth had been fueled by slave trading, that the Clotilda shipmates could just as easily have been kidnapped and sold by other Yoruba speakers. Except for a phone nobleman named Gumpa, all 110 captives who were imprisoned on the Clotilda were almost certainly captured in the same slave raid. Kasulo admitted as much to the writer Zora Neale Hurston in the late 1920s. He referred repeatedly to his shipmates as "my countrymen" and "the folks of my country," and recalled being sold alongside his townsfolk in a single slave pen before his displacement across the Atlantic. Each nation was a barracoon by itself. Hurston understood why captives were segregated. Different ethnic groups might fight, and ethnicities were assumed by slave traders to have specific temperaments and therefore different values. Not all the captives were Yoruba speakers, though. Kasula, Poli, and another Clotilda survivor named Osia Kibi explained that some people were Fulani, Hausa, whose Yoruba speakers knew as Gambari, Ijesa, and Nupe, who Yoruba speakers knew as Takpa, ethnic groups from territories surrounding the former Oyo Empire, who had the tremendous misfortune to be visiting the town at the time of the raid. That was an excerpt from the book The Survivors of Clotilda, The Lost Stories of the Last Captives of the American Slave Trade, written by Hannah Durkin. That book excerpt was found in the story titled Paradise Lost, How the Transatlantic Slave Trade Helped Fuel Violent Conflict in West Africa. It was written by Hannah Durkin, published January 31st, 2024, and published at Literary Hub's website, lithub.com. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.